And one day I had a sweet little note from a neighbor in my milk box, and he said, "I'm so sorry, my Newfoundland found something in your sunflowers and just went tromping through your sunflowers and knocked over your bird feeder and definitely messed up a bunch of stalks of sunflowers. And if there's anything that I put the bird feeder back up, but if there's anything else I can do to repair this damage, let me know." And he left a contact information, and I wrote back and I said, "Well, you know, I'm trying to return this to its original landscape, and there would have been sunflowers here, but there would have also been bison who would have trampled through. And I think your Newfoundland is the closest thing to a bison that our current ecosystem has. So there you go." You know?
Tuned in to How It Looks From Here, Life in the Time of Climate Change. Here in the mashup of reality and uncertainty, life looks different to you than it does to me. The way race and gender, education and work, and everyday circumstances combine in any person's experience, well, it's different. For every person, how it looks matters. So we offer these interviews as a way of giving us all new ideas and inspiration for making our way forward together. I'm Mary Claire, and today we're following up on last month's podcast with a conversation among the members of a panel of five widely recognized authors, each a faculty person at the Elk River Writers Workshop that took place this August in Montana's Paradise Valley. In the last episode of How It Looks From Here, these poets and writers of literary fiction and nonfiction shared their perspectives on climate change. In this episode, the five voices you'll hear join in dialogue about those perspectives. Take a listen to this exchange of ideas among writers Beth Piatot, Camille Dungy, J. Drew Lanham, Gary Ferguson, and Pam Mushuk. Thank you. So everybody breathe in and breathe out. This is a lot of good input, helpful to hear how it looks to these five people. I would like to ask you all first, if any of you has a question for somebody else who spoke on the panel. Do you have a question or a little bit more you'd like to know from someone else who spoke? Camille, go ahead.
I've been thinking so much about this word wilderness, which I do also think is exactly at this root of this Descartesian thinking, this Jeffersonian thinking, this idea that there is an away and that there is a here. And that even the language of the Wilderness Act, land that was untrammeled by man, there are people on this land.
Yeah. Right.
Thank you.
Caring for this land.
Thank you.
And even sometimes trammeling it and doing controlled burns and gardening it and caring for it. And the separation of particularly in the West, right? The separation of that there's that wilderness, there's that away, this pristine space where man is supposed to not, his hand is not supposed to be there, and this other space that is, we can't fix this climate issue if we understand nature is only being someplace away that's pristine and separate. And I just want to hear from all of you ways that you're thinking and you're writing and in your living about how to kind of eradicate that 18th, 19th century notion of pristine wilderness into something that is more useful and more sustainable for how we can make a more diverse, audience of people who feel they have access to the greater than human world and a stake in it and a right to be there. And also an acknowledgement of the history of the people who have been here and have mm-hmm. lessons to teach us. Mm-hmm. How do we do that in the language of our writing and our living to be able to make this necessary shift from that Descartesian separatist thinking into a more holistic community?
Thank you. Thank you. It's a recovery, really. That sounds like what you're saying. What do you think, Beth?
Well, it's not a recovery for us because we've been doing it the whole time.
Thank you.
I mean, like, so that is one thing, you know, around Indigenous survival is that we have continued to have our relationships with our place, which is not wilderness, mm-hmm. which is our home. Mm-hmm. And though wild is a place that is deeply loved and tended mm-hmm. by Indigenous people. Mm-hmm. And we sing to the plants and we have all of these cycles of care and mm-hmm. reciprocity and, you know, being in relationship. Mm-hmm. But then we also have histories of genocide and removal that have strained those. So for us, climate change is the current apocalypse. It's we've already been through, you know, so many in this land, and some wilderness is created through the erasure of Indigenous people.
This one down right by us.
Yeah. And so when we talk about human societies, our Indigenous human societies are not separate from butterfly society and fish society and all the other, you know, beings that live in societies and that we have relationships of responsibility to and with and ongoing. Wilderness, I just feel like for me, wilderness came from the Bible. Mm-hmm. like that. I'm like, well, no wonder they killed John the Baptist. Mm-hmm. Like that guy knew he was a prophet. Like he came in and was like wearing animal skins. That's what Native people do. Like it was the most Indigenous figure in the Bible. Esau. That he was the voice of, yeah, Esau also. Like, mm-hmm. like of course they're going to, you know.
Stone him.
If someone shares a consciousness with the wild and then speaks it, that makes them extremely dangerous. Mm-hmm. And this is also a reason why language revitalization is so important from Indigenous perspectives, is that the consciousness with the land comes from the language of the land. Mm-hmm. And I think it's also, you know, this kind of close tending that you're talking about, like paying attention to what grows here, what is native here, what wants to be here. And, you know, I think one of the most profound things I ever heard one of my tribal members say was, everything just wants to be. Everything wants to be and become. Like, that's it. Mm-hmm. So if that's the order of the world. Okay, I'm going to share the mic.
I'm gonna go south, way south, because that's what I know best. I mean, I spend a good bit of time out west, but I, as an ecologist, I have a lot of, this is gonna sound some sort of ist, but I have a lot of restoration ecologist friends who, and I think about that sort of whole process when you talk about restoration ecology, you know, make America great again, somehow, in some way, by your hubris and what you decide is going to be there and what you decide is not going to be there. You bring things here like starlings or house sparrows or any number of things and then decide to, once they're successful, to decimate them once they've served their purpose. And as a black man, I got to see that like where it is, right? So I take people birding out in these southern landscapes at the South Carolina Low Country. And if you've ever been down there, you get into the Ace Basin and you know, the bird life there is incredible, absolutely incredible. And to look out over this rice marsh that wasn't always rice marsh. It was cypress tupelo swamp. That's what it was. Now, current sea level rise would have pushed that line of cypress tupelo swamp that wanted to be there, just pushed that back. But once the Yemisi people were moved out of that land, it was then deforested by enslaved Africans, mm-hmm. right? Girdling trees and creating as rice moved down river. Make no mistake, you know, you'll hear people talk about King Cotton. Cotton wasn't king, rice was king. Rice was king in South Carolina. Rice had to do more with the mess that this country is in now than cotton ever did. Cotton had a role, but rice financed what went on. But you look at those rice marshes, and I take students down there, and here we are at the Cumbie River, at the site of Harriet Tubman's River Raid, and you look out over that landscape, and you can't see it, but enough mud was moved by enslaved peoples to create pyramids. That much mud, we call it plough. So here's this landscape, this ecologically rich landscape, this critically important landscape for migratory waterfowl and such. And no one wants to restore that to cypress tupelo swamp. Nobody's asking that question, right? And you know, the curious thing about that land now is to understand that the spartina that is growing in those rice impoundments, that those Central and West African enslaved peoples brought within their heads, they weren't just the beasts of burden. Understand, they knew how to move rice, move water across landscapes to within an inch, controlling the tide. That spartina is capturing carbon at a rate equal to forests. Mm-hmm. Those enslaved peoples are still working, still bound to that soil. But people don't want to tell those stories. Is that any less wild than the cypress tupelo? Mm-hmm. Or important? So, you know, these questions of wildness, of wilderness, of what should be there, of what shouldn't be there, of what we want to be in places. You know, so much of it is a figment of what we think we want to see. And, you know, I'm always amazed that people will be drawn to tears at murmurations of starlings on a landscape and set music to it and post it 50 million times. But then those are birds that they want to kill close up. So, I'm sort of in a state of... I don't know, it's a conundrum for me because, you know, I'm pushing back on so much of what I was taught, right? And no one has an answer for me necessarily on what they want to restore and what they don't want to restore, what they want to keep and what they don't want to keep. I dare you to go to South Dakota and tell them that pheasants are invasive. Mm-hmm. I dare you. You'll... But so people have made a choice there. European honeybees, right? But there's a service there, right? Nobody's arguing, nobody's saying, you know what, the next, I'm just gonna go and all these hives, I'm gonna kill them. Because these are workers that, I mean, they've sort of been enslaved in a way. And so we make these decisions about wild and wildness and wilderness. Many of us, based upon what we want to see and what makes us feel good. Not necessarily what's best and what's working. So just to be, right, and how we work things out and how we move through this life and these decisions that we make. You know, Mary, that whole idea of becoming small. Mm-hmm. You know, my grandmother, one of the things that we didn't do when it was storming, you know, it was time to be quiet. And she said, watch God work. Mm-hmm. And so you sat and you just sat and you listened until it was over. And that Gary talks about, you know, those people who've been making all this thunder, to sit back and listen. To sit back and listen and let others talk, including those things that we can't understand, that they're speaking. That they're speaking, and if we listen, we'll hear them. And so I go back to that low country, and I watch swallowtail kites and I, over the landscape, and I think about, and I hear the ancestors talking. But then, you know, what they are seeing, and that bitter misery of all that they went through, that they still have this, they're saving us in ways. And so it's so complex, because here I'm dealing with this landscape of all these stages, first of indigenous genocide, and then of enslavement, and the land bound up in that history. Mm-hmm. You know, and trying to unravel all of that, mm-hmm. I mean, how you write about it, and it's these several levels of discovery, but also trying to help others sort of understand where you are in it, in the roles that you play. So means there's a lot of work for writers who are willing to face some of these issues. But I don't think there are any easy answers for me as an ecologist, but as a Black man, you know, being on that landscape and understanding what happened and understanding the role that we play, and that people would have dismissed us from nature, mm-hmm. right? I refuse to accept that. So I'm the stories that I want to write are stories of, you know, we're there and we've been there. Mm-hmm. But because we haven't fit into your notion of what it means to be out there, mm-hmm. doesn't mean we haven't been.
And this, that if you're associated with wilderness, you're dangerous.
Pam, what are you thinking?
I'd just like to say one more thing about healing and writing and climate change. And that is, I'm writing this book about my long journey through this disease and finding, my path in the world. But I had many healers, and I said, only listed two of them, but I had a medicine woman. The medicine woman of the Tona Atam Nation was sending her owl people during my surgery to make sure that the surgery went okay. There were prayer circles among two prayer circles in North Carolina that were organized by African American friends of mine, and two curanderas from New Mexico and one from Mexico that were helping me, sending me mushroom extracts and other plants. But healers, when I started writing about all of the healers that came together all at once, as if an orchestra was being formed. Mm. And they did. They came all at once to help me. And I think, you know, I sent that book to one big agent, white male agent in New York, big name. He said, you've got to take all, you can only stay with Western medicine, or this is never going to be published. This will never sell. He said, take the, how dare you talk to cancer survivors about metaphysical things? He said that. I have the letter. And that's the problem sometimes with looking at climate change. We need all kinds of forces and all kinds of voices and all kinds of healings for this to happen. Thank you.
Well, if we
thank
keep
you, Pam.
Circling back to the same people who've been speaking, then we get the same answers. Mm-hmm. And those aren't working.
Yes. Yes.
Right.
Yes.
We need new answers.
Yes. Yes. Gary, what's on your mind?
If I could say something too, I was so hard on science earlier. I want to give it some credit right now. I think one of the most hopeful things is biology, especially, at least at the cutting edge, is moving away from what had been essentially a mirror of classical physics, where everything could be measured and thereby controlled and thereby predicted and whatnot. And there really realizing that this is all pretty much a rhythm of exchange. And so biologists are starting to use string theory and chaos theory and things like that to understand the fact that what you understand in this moment doesn't have a whole lot to do with what your capacity to understand what happens a month from now. And you know, one of the heartening things for me is to, and this is really just science catching up to what indigenous cultures have known for a very, very, very long time, and that's that. Even with each of us, we don't end at our skin. We really don't. You have more microcells in you than you have human cells. You've got 100 trillion human cells in you. And without those microbes, a lot of which came to live with you after you were born, so they're other life forms, that's what's breaking down the nutrients that you take in through the food and allowing your brains to work and your muscles to work. It's the sun, the daylight, it's setting your melatonin levels, which not only allow you to sleep, it's what helps you fight cancer and prevent cancer in the first place. The coolest thing in the world, you walk out among these trees, yes, you're breathing out carbon dioxide, they're taking it in, they're giving off oxygen, we know about that. But now we know that they're giving off chemical compounds called phytoncides, which actually every breath you take under that tree will help fortify your immune system and strengthen mm-hmm. your vital organs. We are in a great and grand rhythm of exchange, and to think that I'm the self-contained person I am, that the edge of my skin is, again, a kind of dividing, a kind of separation that needs to be profoundly altered. And I think science can be a part of the solution.
Camille, are you having a thought? Yeah.
I do, and it comes back to coming both to language and to knowledge in the way that language and drives and delivers our knowledge, so kind of being open to more. What you just said about the trees, that there are some trees, that, particularly some conifers, that are antiseptic, antibiotic. Like, they do Lysol, right? Like, the pine-scented Lysol. Right? Like, that is what a tree is already doing. Yeah. Or relatively recently, some CDC study that said, you know, if you open your window, not open the window, just open the curtains to get light in. You know, when grandma said, just turn the light on, you won't be, like, it has antidepressant possibilities and actions. It, surprisingly, burning sweet grass and sage, antibacterial, antiviral potentials in that, all of these ancient wisdoms, right? Mm-hmm. We call a particular kind of farming that is a post-World War II version of farming conventional farming. Right? So then I think let's rethink our language, because a localized farming, a seasonally related farming, you eat this when it is in season and you wait longingly for it around the rest of the year until it's that in that season again. These kinds of knowledges that humans have had, that we have dismissed for a variety, not everybody has dismissed, but is very frequently dismissed for a variety of reasons, having to do with settler colonialism and misogyny and racism and money, right? Those yeah. are the like key yeah. reasons that those are dismissed. But also the intelligences of our plants and of our animals that know, in that crazy Colorado weather, I've learned to pay attention to the birds. And when the birds sort of start to right. do stuff, I'm like, okay, what's coming? You know, there's like, there's wind's coming or rain's coming or something's coming, because this is not the time of day they usually go into the spruce. So something's happening because they are seeking shelter, right? So I can watch that and then figure out what I need to do for myself. That kind of attunement, I live in the suburbs. I can do that in the suburbs. You can do that in an urban setting. You don't have to be out in the rural or the wilderness to be able to have that kind of attention and awareness. And I just feel like that it means moving a little slower in some ways and moving a little faster in other ways and paying attention differently. But again, I think it frequently comes down to language and like pushing against calling something conventional farming. And understanding that that's actually disruptive farming, like that's like that way of farming is It was new and destructive and failing. And we should go back to the conventions, right, of other times instead.
Yeah, you used the word aggressive. Aggressive farming is what, yeah, and you're talking not that.
Yeah.
Yeah, being connected. Okay, everybody, you've been listening for a while. I bet you've got a question or two. If you do, don't be shy. And I'm going to do the Oprah thing and maybe have you come up. Although I'm not as good as she is, but yes. Yeah. Sorry, say that again.
We all want to fly and have wanted to fly since we were babies. And we remembered flying in our other lives.
I mean to defy what holds us down.
Yeah.
Right? I mean it's aspirational. I don't think that you can't help it, right? You fall into bird metaphor before you fall into many others, but that flight.
And we would love to have the sight of the eagle that be that high up in the air and be able to see under the snow.
Also, it's song.
Yes, absolutely.
Amen. Birds really communicate, and once you learn, I actually am not walk with Drew, and he picks out the song. I'm not very good at that, but I recognize and acknowledge the beauty of the song.
Oh, you're absolutely right. This morning, when I was up on the ridge, what I heard first was that warbling vireo, and I couldn't find her. And I was looking all over, going through the bushes, and there she was, feeding her fledgling. But I heard the song first.
See, I would have been like, pretty bird song. I would have done the warbling vireo.
We've got another question over here.
So maybe a point, counterpoint to that last question. What about roots and fungus and underground?
Who's a fungus?
I love that stuff. The underground world is the great chance for us to, again, not only discover lots and lots of life forms that we didn't even know existed, but the communication and the interdependence. You know, I talked about these lessons, these qualities of nature. That's number one. It's interdependence and the fungal networks that allow trees to not only pass nutrients back and forth, sugars, carbons, but to alert another tree, maybe of a different species, 40 yards away, that there's an insect invasion happening, so that that tree can express its genetic capacity for chemicals that will help slow down that invasion. This is amazing. And again, across species, it's happening. And so I think that's one of the most exciting things going on in the world right now.
Camille, go ahead.
Forrest Gander and Brenda Hillman both write extensively about lichen. And on my way here, I stopped by some petroglyphs outside of Thermopolis, Wyoming, and took some pictures of the lichen there for Brenda, and just kept thinking, some of these lichen, which are, by the way, two species who come together, right? So the true diversity building life, but also some of those lichen may have been there thousands of years ago when the people made those carvings, right? So the longevity of some of these fungi that are, that's this mind-blowingly beautiful thing, because they seem small, but they're vast.
Beth, go ahead.
Just back to my nerdy language revitalization, when you said, who is writing about roots? I was like, well, I write about roots because of the structure of our language. We have a polysynthetic language that there's a root, and the verb is in the middle of the word, and then the who and the how is the front of the word, and the when and the where is the end of the word. So I have a poem called Because Our Roots Are in Rivers, not Latin. So even, you know, those are the kind of roots that I was thinking about, but the other roots are also very cool. But they're all kind of the same thing. Like where does the language come from that comes out of these roots?
Thank you, Beth. Anybody else have a question? Yes, here's one.
I wondered how you see education of children playing into what we're discussing, and because that's where the hope is going to come from, children who have learned how to live in the world. So I just wondered what approaches you thought about.
Thank you. What do you think? Did you all hear that? Okay. Drew, you got a thought?
I say more outside, but then there's the conundrum of black and brown communities being downstream of toxic flames, and you know, almost an order of magnitude greater in chronic pulmonary disease. So, you know, I say same water, same air, but right now we ain't breathing the same water, we ain't drinking the same air, or breathing the same air. So. But I think, you know, one of the things I would love to see would be the ability to, you know, to think about bringing children back to these ideas of soil and growth and hands. And so we talk about community gardens and school gardens, and there are some school districts that are more successful than others. But when you have children that think peanuts grow on trees, that a significant portion of children think that bacon comes from plants, that they don't understand that, you know, where meat comes from, that there's life and death in that, that there's life and death in agriculture. So I think to have some point of contact for children's soil, really, mm-hmm. with soil itself. You know, I think about the pleasure I used to have as a kid of going barefoot.
Yeah.
And feeling the ground. And I don't know how that happens, man. I don't know if, you know, there's probably some sign-off that you got to do on it. but it does. And so by the time the kids get to me, you know, they're adults, really, but their disconnection from life on Earth and from soil and where things come from, mm-hmm. how things grow, mm-hmm. is disconcerting. So I would love to see somehow credit given to schools and school districts for growing food.
Yeah.
That there somehow be credits built in to that, but also children are encouraged from a career standpoint that there is life in soil and green, and we don't do a good job of that. You know, that STEM means anything but growing things.
Uh-huh. Right now, that's really true. What, Camille? You're raising kiddos right now.
Yeah,
right.
I was like, I'm talking every single time, and I'm not going to talk about it this time, but I can't not do this one. because, like, I gave you the subtitle of the history of a black mother's garden. Just do a little lit review on your own, and look and see, with the exception of Amy Nasukka Matottle's beautiful new book, but that came out in 2020, and some books by Barbara Kingsolver and Robert Walkimer. Most of these are post 2000. Mothers do not show up in the environmental canon. Like, apparently, people are just, they just happen. And then they tromp off into the wilderness. What does that mean? That the environmental canon has erased the act of caretaking small people. Like, that is a rupture in the fabric of, as you're saying, of the way that the world works. Yes, the correction is happening, right? I'm working on my book. I mentioned these people, but like, I just did that on one hand. That is ridiculous. Oh, there's another book that is just re-released by a woman named Josephine Johnson. It's a beautiful, beautiful book called Inland Island, and she speaks very actively about mothering and caretaking, and in some of her fiction, she has alternate paths for women, some of whom follow, become mothers, and some of whom it's very clear that it's not going to be the thing that they do, and there's other ways that they are caretakers. But I just really believe that unless we understand each other in a relational, to use that word, in a relational, in a sense of community, in sense of communal care and understanding, and neighborliness and all of that, these questions that we have, if we cannot figure out how to honor our own homes and the structure of homes and how those are built, how do we honor the big home, right? And how do we understand how we have to live in community in order to resolve the crises that we're facing and take care of the next generation?
Yeah, thank you. You know, think, just, this is occurring to me for some reason, Camille, as you speak, the last 3 days. You don't have to remember them precisely right now, but all of the people, all of the plants, all of the animals, everything that went into getting you from where you were to where you are right now, including the food you ate at lunch, every bit of the food you've eaten here, every bit of the food you've eaten every one of those days. If you just stop and consider the diversity and complexity and richness and generosity. You know, one of the things that we have found ourselves observing, which I don't think will be news to any of you, is that we really need nature, we people, but nature doesn't really need us. But I've had people argue with me about that because I think there is a way, as Beth, you were describing, that humans are being part of being right-sized, and please check me on this, is that there is a relationship there as well. And so we are invited to be here. We are invited and welcomed here, not in destruction, but in great gratitude and presence. And thank you for being writers. Oh, and thank you all. Beth, it looked like something crossed your mind.
Oh, you're giving such a beautiful ending. I was just gonna say that sense of humans being part of it is that the animals' perspective on humans is that they are pitiful. I mean, they're right? And so it is the animals' generosity, and you know, that and so having those stories that sort of show how pathetic and useless humans are, you know, is really important to have humility. And just, I want to comment on what Camila was saying about the canon, and it's like, well, if your canon starts with Thoreau, like that's your template, someone who erases all of women's labor, you know, like very, very intentionally. And so I really love the way you're thinking about that. But I really should not have taken away from your beautiful.
Well, on the contrary,
it's very beautiful.
Well, thank you all for being here, and you're welcome to go. Learn more about each of these authors and the Elk River Writers Workshop in our show notes. Treat yourself and pick up the writing of these beautiful beings. Again, check our show notes to find lists of each participant's books. And now before we go, a quick pitch for our podcast. If you like what you're hearing on How It Looks From Here, make sure to subscribe. Let's get these perspectives out there. Tell your friends and family. Share a link right now with someone you know would enjoy learning how it looks from another viewpoint. You can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you find your podcasts. How It Looks From Here is an educational collaboration between Full Ecology and the System Zoo. How It Looks From Here was created and produced by me, Mary Claire, and Joe LaVisca, editing by Joe LaVisca, music by Cedar Mathers Wynn and Gary Ferguson. Find us on Instagram at Full Ecology and at www.fullecology.com. Keep listening and be in touch.